All righty, I'm going to, as is the nature of such things, I'm going to repeat some of the things Mark talked about, and I'm going to talk about some other things and some details that he didn't go into. Basically, we look at this and we say, how is this different from if we didn't have PET? I kind of wish we had one of these little signs here to pass out to people at some meeting about PET shielding. But essentially, we're dealing with 511 keV photons, so that's a lot higher than diagnostic x-rays. It's a lot higher than lots of nuclear medicine. That results in an increased exposure rate from the doses in the hot lab and from the injected patients. And it calls for greatly increased thicknesses of required shielding compared to a conventional diagnostic installation. We have somewhat different requirements for patient handling during the injection and the uptake phase compared to normal nuclear medicine. And then when we have combined modality scanners, we have to consider both the gamma ray and x-ray hazards. When we look at the F-18 patient as a source here, we see why this is a bigger difficulty. This slide represents coalescence of the results, published results from a number of different investigators in 2003. And you can see that essentially you're seeing things on the order of a tenth of a microsievert per hour per megabecquerel, or if you want to convert that into old units, 0.38 millirems per hour per millicurie. You can compare that to the type of dose rate you get around a patient that's been injected with technetium-99, which are these numbers down here, and you find that the fluorine-18 patient represents a source that's 8 times more potent as far as the dose that people that are around that patient are going to receive. Then we look at this issue about the penetration and what implications that has. If we look at the number of HVLs we might require for a given shielding problem, and we compare x-rays in the diagnostic range versus the annihilation photons from PET. Over here in the diagnostic range, we see 1/2 value layer, 16th is plenty, plenty, plenty. 2, 4, 8, 10 half value layers, a 16th is always the answer. We saw that this morning, didn't we? A 16th is always the answer. On the case of PET, we want to get 1/2 value layer, and as mentioned this morning, we're going to round to commercially available lead thicknesses. 1/2 value layer is going to cost us 1/4 inch of lead, and it's just going to get worse from there. So shielding PET when we need very many half value layers is an expensive proposition. Remembering this morning's bottom line, that for diagnostic x-rays, we can apply three computational models out of NCRP 149, and we find that 1/16th is always the answer. So, I heard Bob Dixon make this remark at one point, you know, that we have this book here that tells us what to do, and the answer is 1/16th, which we could write at the end of the book. We normally, in this case, when we're doing x-ray shielding, we say, oh, okay, here's the room I'm shielding, and I'm going to look over here, and I'm going to look at this person in this room here that's 4 meters away, and I'm going to calculate the dose from this room to that guy, and I'm going to get an answer. My answer is probably I require less than 1/16 of an inch, and 1/16 of an inch gives me more half values than I need. I'm good. I calculated to the closest point in some sense. That's all that I need to do. This is not true in PET, as Mark explained earlier. We'll see that it is true that normally we don't need very many half value layers, thank goodness. We need 1 to 3 half value layers. And we tend to put in just what we need because it's an expensive business. The implication here is that when we do the calculations, we need to do them a little bit better. At every protection point that we need to look at, we need to include the effects of all the different sources. So I've got this injection room, that injection room, this scan room. I need to add together the effects of all these different sources when I'm working my problem. This corresponds, I mean, we already touched on this earlier this morning when Donna was talking. She talked about adjusting downward the protection limit. And this is just another way of looking at it, that we have to consider the additional sources that are in the area, which is something that typically we haven't done because half-value layers are so cheap in diagnostic X-ray. Now, this shows the general schema for doing a PET scan, an FDG whole body scan. And the patient comes in and gets injected. As Mark indicated, the upper limit of what we inject is about 20 millicuries. It may go down to 5 to 8 millicuries, depending on what you're doing, or less if you're doing peds. 30 to 90 minutes later, I too have not corrected my slide here, 30 to 90 minutes later, after you've had them sitting over here during the uptake phase, you'll have them empty their bladder, you'll put them in the scanner, you'll position the patient and scan them. The scan nowadays, at one time, scans took an hour at least. Nowadays, 10 minutes for a whole body scan, up to 30 minutes, depending on what particular equipment you have. Then you check the scan and you kick the patient loose, and the radiologist gets on with his job. I've indicated those steps that have the highest technologist exposure with the little stars here. So just as in conventional nuclear medicine, they have the highest exposure when they're handling the radioactive material or when they're handling the patient. There are some slides in the handout that's in the book that indicate the talk about the size of the technologist exposure and how to control and reduce it. Essentially, the answer is the technologist gets about a millirem, 10 microsieverts per procedure. Well, over the course of a year, that can add up. It's still within acceptable limits, but it's something you have to think about when you look at the technologist that's pregnant. And you may have to control their exposure more carefully. I'm going to skip those slides and go on to the next slide. This is a picture of our previous PET facility at UT Southwestern. And it shows essentially the patients coming in the front door, waiting, going back to injection rooms, to the hot toilet, which we call the hot potty at our place. From the hot potty, they go down to one of the scan bays and they get scanned and then they get released. The radioactive materials come in the back door, go to the hot lab, and then to the injection room. The hot lab and the injection rooms and the hot potty are all nice and close so as to minimize the dose to the technologist during this phase of the study. Now, what I want to point out to you is that all the hot stuff, and this was in a strip center, okay? We were off from our campus. We have other occupancies next to us. And all of the hot stuff is in the center of the facility because you've got the distance out there that's separating you, your hot stuff, from the occupancies on either side that you can't control very well. This can save you a lot of money. If you can get involved in the architectural phase of the planning, you can save your clients money. And I know there was one facility I was associated with planning, and they sent me this plan, and I said, you know, this plan isn't very good because you've put this scanner up in the middle of the hospital, and you have a lot of areas you can't control all around it. And they said, no, that's really what we want to do. So I said, okay. And I calculated how much lead they were going to need. And they said, we're going to put this in the basement. Okay. So down in the basement, I had dirt on two sides of this area, and it worked out much better. There had to be much less lead involved in the design. Now, let's take a little walkabout inside this area. This is not structural shielding, but it's questions we get asked and things we get involved with when we get initially involved in PET. Here's the dose that's come in. Oops, I've lost my little pointer. There we go. Here's the dose that's come in. There's a number of different shipping cases you may have it come in. They share one quality, and that is that they're heavy. This particular one weighs 66 pounds. We receive them now that weigh up to about 90 pounds. Okay, you don't want the tech wagging that thing around, trying to lift it up somewhere in order to get into it. So it's best to set up the design of the hot lab so it can sit here and the tech can just yank it out of there and drop it into the dose calibrator. This is an alternative design. This whole little cylinder here that the syringe sits in is solid tungsten. So it's smaller, but it still weighs quite a bit. Here's your L block and your dose calibrator. You can see the dose calibrator has a 2-inch ring of lead around it. The L block has got more than 2 inches of lead in it, so there's lots and lots of lead that's involved here. Here's the wipe counter here, the little well counter. You can see these blocks back there. The blocks are back there because there's a PET scanner on the other side of the wall. And when there's a patient walking into that PET scanner room, or when the calibration sources are out for the PET scanner, the little well counter picks that stuff up. And so you have to provide extra shielding. That's an example. This down here is an example of the tungsten syringe shields that we use. Now we're getting into where we're talking about serious problems. This is an injection room. Patient comes in here. You want the patient to remain quiet because otherwise you have anomalous uptake in places you don't want it. So they get injected and they have to stay in here for 30 to 90 minutes. And this is really where the money is going to be as far as the shielding involved. After that, they go into the scanner bay. And of course, you've got essentially three different providers of scanners right now. It's best to know which one you're talking about because that's going to determine the scan parameters, how much you may inject and how long you may be scanning. So it's best if you can figure this out. Otherwise, you're going to have to make some assumptions. So we come down now. Before, Mark indicated there was a lot of questions about how to shield this before we came out with the task group report. There was a thread on the list server, the physics list server, about how to shield the control room. How to shield the control room ranged from 0 to 1 inch of lead. So you can see that there was not a consensus on how much shielding you needed in these areas. So we tried to bring consensus. There is an erratum that Mark mentioned that has been published in Medical Physics to correct the errors there. Now, Mark indicated we use this conventional approach. We're calculating the upper limit of barrier transmission, what we call the required barrier transmission, based on the protection limit, how far away from the source we are to the protected spot, gamma, the decay constant for the radionuclide, the occupancy, the number of patients per week, the injected activity. This term here includes the decay and elimination, so it's a correction term to take into account the fact that the source is decaying. All these PET isotopes are short-lived. We're usually talking about, in most applications these days, we're talking about FDG, half-life of 109 minutes. So it decays a lot over the course of the scan process. T, lowercase t here, is the integration time during which the source is in place for calculating the dose delivered to our protected point. And R sub t is this reduction factor that takes into account the decay. I'm sorry, this takes into account decay before the patient comes into the area, and it takes into account elimination, this F factor. Okay, so we're ready to do our shielding. We've got our equation. We have to acquire the normal list of stuff for doing the job. We need to know what's happening above, below, and at our sides. We need to know how many patients per week that we're dealing with, the isotopes that we're dealing with, the type of studies that we're doing. Now, most people in here, I'm sure, are interested in the whole body PET for oncology purposes. If you're doing brains or hearts, it's a different story, and the amount of time that the scan takes and the amount of uptake time involved are different. The type of equipment is important. The dose delivery schedule, so this depends on how far away you are from a cyclotron. Maybe we're less than a mile away from a cyclotron, so we can get isotope throughout the day. We don't have to have a lot sitting around. But if you're a long ways away, then you may have a whole heap of isotope sitting in your hot lab, since you maybe you only get one delivery a day. So you need to be aware of the delivery time. Then you need to know the CT technique factors, the number of scans per patient, the amount of non-PET CT workload that you expect. Now, in terms of talking about how important CT can be, I have to reiterate what Mark said. Usually when you've worked the problem, you find out that the lead shielding for the PET has made CT inconsequential. But that's not always true. It depends to some, you know, it depends on sort of your mixture of whether you're using lead or whether you're using distance to accomplish the attenuation. It depends on the mixture in between PET and CT cases that you're using. Recall, we're dealing with very few half-value layers for the PET, and it's possible to pick up those half-value layers. If you had enough space, you wouldn't have to have any lead for the PET because you only need a few half-value layers, so you're talking about doubling the distance just a couple of times to get them. That wouldn't take care of the CT dose by itself, necessarily. So that's why you have to look at each individual case. Now, I said you have to include all of the radiation sources that are involved in your plan. The one where the lead's really going to build up is going to be this one. The patient, after they've been injected, while they're in the uptake room. That's when you have the most radioactivity, and that's where the patient will spend most of the time. So that is our important spot. But you also have the doses sitting in the hot lab. You have the calibration sources for the scanner. You have the patient when they're in the scanner, when they're in the hot toilet. You have in old-style PET scanners, you had transmission sources instead of the CT part, and you have to account for those transmission sources. And then you have the CT part. Our target values, of course, we've already thoroughly addressed, so it's 100 microsieverts per week or 10 millirems per week. In uncontrolled areas, it's 20 microsieverts per week or 2 millirems per week. Now, we can estimate what the maximum throughput of the facility is. In my own experience, I have found it necessary to be skeptical of what people tell me about what they're going to do, because people may tell me, oh, we're hardly going to do any PET at all. We're really going to use this as a CT scanner a lot of the time. Some of the administrators still don't have much faith in PET, but they have a lot of faith in CT. Well, then you visit them and you find out that they're doing a whole lot more CT cases than they told you. So you can look at the type of scanner and the type of studies that you're going to do and determine how long the patient's going to be in the scan room. They're going to be in there at scan time plus whatever the positioning time is likely to be. You know how long the work day is, so you can figure out how many patients per day you're going to work with this formula here. And you can calculate how many uptake areas they should have designed into the area, or if they're willing to listen to you, how many uptake areas you're going to tell them they need. This graph shows the way the workflow works. The patient comes in. This is scheduled for 90-minute uptakes. The patient comes in and gets injected at 7:30 and goes onto the scanner at 9. 30 minutes later, you're ready to stick another guy in there, so you better have injected him at 8 o'clock. And you just go through the day. So for this scenario of a 90-minute uptake and a 30-minute scan, you could do 15 patients a day if you've got really good techs that are going to keep up the pace there. And you're going to need 3 uptake rooms. Now, as Mark indicated, we looked at 2 things. We looked at the dose constant for bare sources. So we're talking about what's appropriate over in the hot lab or while the tech is handling the sources, and settled on 0.143 microsieverts per hour per megabecquerel, or half a millirem per hour per millicurie. We examined the data that was available to us on the F18 injected patient as a source. this data had to be deconvolved a lot because it's taken with different delay times to the measurement point. Don't know whether the patient had emptied their bladder or not. And different people use different types of dose exposure to dose conversions. So there's a lot of sources of variability. We selected this value of 0.092 microsieverts per hour per megabecquerel, or 0.34 millirems per hour. If you look in the literature, you can find that the patient can easily eliminate 20% of this dose from their bladder after 1 to 2 hours post-injection. We chose a value of 15% in order to be conservative. Then we have this R factor that accounts for the decay of the source during the scanning process or during the uptake process. So it's just the exponential decay of the source. If we look at the effect of these corrections, the blue line here shows the dose we would get to someone that's standing a meter away from the patient that's been injected with 10 millicuries, 370 megabecquerels of fluorine 18. If the blue line assumes there's no decay, that the half-life is infinite, we've got our dose constant, and we know the injected dose, and we just calculate how much dose we're going to get at any given time, integration time. The red line shows what happens when we add in the physical decay. So this is the reduction factor. So the source is decaying. The yellow line here shows the effects of including the self-shielding of the patient. So instead of getting the full gamma's worth, we're getting a value of about 60% of that, as Mark said. So this is the difference in between the bare and the injected patient dose constants that we used. And then finally, the green line shows the effect of the patient emptying their bladder 60 minutes after injection. Now let's look out here, 90 minutes into the process, and we see that if we compare what would have happened if we didn't make any corrections with what happens when we make the corrections, that there's a factor of 2 in between the doses we would calculate for this imaginary person. A factor of 2, if we had to produce that by the use of shielding, would require a quarter inch of lead. So this is a worthwhile project to look at these corrections. It can save us a lot of money. Now, as Mark pointed out, we provide 2 simplified versions of the equation here. This is essentially the real deal up here, but in order to simplify things, we present 2 versions. One for the uptake room has the value of 10.9 here, and 10.9 is 1 over gamma, so it represents the effect of this term right here, in hours per microsievert, megabecquerels per meter squared. There is no physical decay before the patient comes in the uptake room. He gets injected there, so there's no correction for that. And the reduction factor would be the one that corresponds to the uptake time, T sub U. In the scan bay, the corresponding practical equation has a value of 12.8 up here, corresponding to 1 over gamma and the effects of voiding 15% of the injected activity before imaging begins. Now we include this F factor here to take into account the fact that we're in the scan bay, the source is decayed before they ever came into the scan bay, but we're using, for input, we are using the injected dose here. So we multiply it by this factor that takes into account the decay prior to entering the scan bay. Okay. Doug was good enough to do the work, the complicated and difficult work on this project. So he calculated the transmission factors for the different materials. And as Mark indicated, we have graphs and tables of the coefficients to go into the Archer equation so that you can analytically calculate the transmission or the required thickness, depending on which direction you're going in. Now let's look at the example of the uptake room. So this is the simple example before we get to the facility design that Mark was talking about. I do not have a picture here because I couldn't choose between the Simpkin chair model and the Dixon toilet model. So you have to use your imagination as to what the protected person is doing in this example. But there is an uncontrolled area with 100% occupancy 4 meters from the patient. The patient is the source. We have 40 patients a week are injected in this room with 15 millicuries of FDG, and they have a 1 hour uptake time. How much shielding is needed? So you just plug into the equation. In order to keep things straight from my mind when I'm looking at more complicated cases that might not correspond to the two cases, I use the unadulterated equation. But you get the same result whether you use the 10 point whatever it is, or you just plug in all the numbers to the original transmission equation. The answer that you get is 1.2 centimeters of lead. So half an inch of lead is required to shield this person that's 4 meters away from the couch in the injection room. And that's quite a bit of lead. Or 15 centimeters of concrete, so 6 inches of concrete. If we look at the scan room, so the difference here is going to be that this patient now has decayed for an hour, and the patient has emptied their bladder and eliminated 15% of the retained dose. How much shielding is needed now? Now the protected point is 3 meters away from the patient. Otherwise, same case. Okay, they're going to spend 30 minutes in the scan bay. How much shielding do we need? The answer is 0.8 centimeters of lead or 11.3 centimeters of concrete. So a little over 4 inches of concrete in this case. So, and a little less than three-eighths of an inch of lead. So that gives you a flavor for the type of shielding we need around the facility. This looked at only the single source case. So here we didn't include the fact that, well, we've got these two rooms next to one another and we have to sum their doses at the protected point and then start adding in shielding. This is my personal opinion of how we would, how you could proceed. First of all, you interact with the architect in order to lay it out so that you minimize the shielding requirements. So you put the hot stuff in the core and you put other stuff around it that you have control over so that you can minimize your lead requirement. You identify all your sources, including the CT, and you integrate over the period that that source is in place, giving the dose per week or dose per hour at 1 meter. You identify all the barriers that will contribute to the shielding, including the pigs, the containers, everything. I sit down and I establish test points at the perimeter and at sensitive locations, and I identify which barriers shield each point. Typically, each point's going to be shielded by multiple barriers when you are looking at the overall facility. Then you calculate the doses without attenuation, and you start adding in lead or concrete as necessary. Now, in reference to the question that Donna had about this, now I look at the sum dose, but I keep track of what part of it is CT and what part of it is PET. And so when I add a layer of lead, I know how much to attenuate the CT and how much to attenuate the PET in order to make sure that I'm not overestimating the amount of shielding that I need. I find that my personal take on this is that I like to spread the lead. Instead of having a few walls that have an awful lot of lead, I like to hang lead over multiple walls that otherwise maybe I wouldn't put lead there. But I can spread the lead out. That lets us use conventional construction techniques with leaded wallboard, instead of maybe having to have some humongous piece of lead that requires a different approach in order to support it. And then I stop after I've got enough. So I do kind of an iterative process, a fiddling process. So I put this much lead here and this much lead there, and I play with it until I have a solution. You can do this with a spreadsheet. You can do it with pencil and paper. It's very tedious. Or you can use some type of a programmed approach. I'm going to show you some results that were obtained with spreadsheets, and I'm going to show you results that were obtained, in my particular case, using MathCAD as my computational engine. So here's a spreadsheet example. I put in all of my source definitions, different rooms, different scanners. I put in my shielding constants and my material definitions. I have a list of all the different test points and which barriers shield those test points from the different sources. So I just sum all this stuff up. It's a humongous and complicated spreadsheet. But you can do it that way. You can do the whole business in Excel. Now this shows a grid calculation based in MathCAD. So I have evenly spaced test points, and then I put my sources at specific points inside there. And I essentially do a calculation that these numbers that you can see here, like 4 is the ratio of the calculated dose at that point to the target dose when it's been adjusted for occupancy. So as you can see, this shows why you've got to be careful about, you know, you've got a corridor and you look at that corridor and you say, ah, that's fine. But you go over here where you have 100% occupancy instead of a corridor occupancy, and all of a sudden you're not so fine. So at any rate, you can then look at this picture that you generate and you can have a pretty good intuitive understanding of which barriers you need to start adding in. This was a kind of a special purpose facility here. It was really put in to do some specified research. They weren't going to do very many patients. Those patients, I was assured, were going to stay there for the cool down period. After the scan, they weren't going to be doing another patient, so this was in a specialty hospital. So there's one injection room, one hot toilet, the hot lab, and the scan bay. Okay, and the control room. So this is my controlled area, and then everything outside here is uncontrolled. And this is a different variety of this plot that's gives you a pixelized impression of how hot these areas are and how much remediation you need to do. Now, they told me 4 patients a day. I actually didn't believe this. I still don't believe it. I figure that they will be doing more than 4 patients a day. They're doing a lot of CT work in the room also. Now, when you go through and then you lead up all these walls appropriately, I found that I didn't have to put more than 5/16 of an inch of lead into any given wall. I did require ceiling and floor shielding here above and below. But it wasn't necessary to run the box all the way to the ceiling because of the particular geometry in this case. So I did not have to run it above 7 feet. Sometimes you find that you do have to run the lead above 7 feet to avoid specific problems on the floor above. Oopsies happen. So I had too complicated a scheme, unfortunately, because I needed floor shielding and I needed ceiling shielding. And I didn't need as much in one as in the other. This is installed as lead sheet that's bonded to plywood, and then the plywood is laid onto brackets that are bolted into the structural beam web above and below. Unfortunately, the contractor switched the ceiling and the floor. Now, that was unfortunate. It was also unfortunate I had told him, you call me when you start installing this lead so that I can come over and keep an eye on it while you're doing it. They called me and said, well, we're all done and you need to come right over because we're going to close all the walls. So I go over and I climb up into this, stick my head up into the access ports in the ceiling and go downstairs and do the same thing, and I find they've switched the lead. Unfortunately, this lead was put into place after all of the ductwork. The lead was put into place before all the ductwork and plumbing and fire and electrical was put into the ceiling. So essentially, it was not removable. They hired a rather slim individual that could fit into this channel in between the lead sheets on the plywood and this big channel, you know, that is in between the webs, the structural webs in a poured concrete floor. He went through there and installed the additional lead that was necessary. But it would have been better to just fail to inform them they could save money by a substantial amount of money by having different thicknesses of lead above and below and just made it all the same. Okay. Now this is an example now of our newest facility here. I keep losing my little, there it is, marker here. So this is our new facility that we have just moved into. There's 4 injection rooms, 2 hot potties, 3 scan bays. We designed it, unfortunately the design started 4 years ago, so we were designing it at a time when we felt like 4 injection rooms were going to be enough for this number of scan bays. That's no longer true. Overall, it was possible to shield this with no lead in excess of 3/8 of an inch. However, the north wall here presented a problem. That's right next to the injection rooms, you see. So that's where I need the most shielding. That north wall, if I can't count on what's on the other side of the wall, was going to require almost an inch of lead. We solved that by using 16 inches of dry-laid full-density concrete block. Now, the reason we took that approach, this bay has on the drawing, it says cyclotron. Now, we don't have the money to buy the cyclotron or to run the cyclotron right now, but it's supposed to be ours. But I can't guarantee that the dean won't put a bunch of offices over there next year. He may change his mind about letting us keep that space. But by using a wall that is disassemblable, then we have a flexible route if we do, in fact, put the cyclotron in there, and one that cost less than putting that much thickness of lead into place. We talked about looking up, down, and sideways. Here is the facility. This is the dose map on the floor above. And you can see these little hot spots. That's because the architect decided that right above my injection rooms was the place to put major penetrations for the air conditioning duct that carries all the air on this floor down from the mechanical room above. The good news is it's a mechanical room, so I've got a good occupancy I can apply there. Now you can see here, these are the 3 scanners. You can see them casting a little glow up there. And then this is the trouble spot here. These are the injection rooms. So there was extra lead required over the injection rooms, even though we have a low occupancy. And then I had to build a little shack around these penetrations. It turned out up on the floor above that I had enough distance and I did not need to worry about the corresponding penetrations that were on the floor above. So shows you the utility of having kind of a pictorial glance at what's going on, because you can analyze the situation and know and have a fairly clear idea as to what you need to do. There's a picture of what happens when you start building a full density concrete block wall. Full density concrete blocks aren't what you buy at Home Depot. Okay, that's something called Haydite that's foamed with air. You had to have these specialty made. We had to find some place there in Dallas that would pour these things, and you have to work hard with them to get dimensional control. And they're stacked up so that the seams are misaligned to provide consistent shielding. Then it's covered with a gypsum wall to keep someone from borrowing stuff to make bookcases out of or something like that. This shows the use of portable shielding. So here we have a situation where we have an ejection room chair. We have portable shields behind it and beside it, or over here on the wall. This is some slides that I have courtesy of Richard Massoth. It shows things that you may have to do when you're in an existing facility that won't tolerate much architectural monkeying around to get your structural shielding in place.